From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the commercial banking crisis that no one wants to talk about. The experts say at least 86 banks could fail early next year. Whoever wins the presidential election will have to deal with it. But until last night's debate, none of the candidates were discussing it. We'll talk with journalist Jerry Knight. He co-wrote the Washington Post story that Ross Perot referred to last night. Also, Brandon Tartikoff tells us about holding the best worst job in the world. He's the former head of NBC Entertainment. He pulled NBC out of the ratings cellar and into the number one slot with hits like Hill Street Blues and The Cosby Show. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Choice 92, a new Frontline documentary about the presidential campaign. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The president embarked on a whistle-stop tour of the South today, making stops across Georgia. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold filed this report.
While his opponent heads to traditionally Republican states such as Wyoming and Nevada, Mr. Bush is chugging through Georgia, a state that in two decades voted Democratic in only one presidential election when favorite son Jimmy Carter was on the ballot. At his first stop in the small town of Norcross, President Bush stuck close to the script he's used for the past month and in the debates, calling his opponent a waffler who has flip-flopped on his draft record. "You cannot lead by misleading," Mr. Bush told a cheering crowd as he donned an Atlanta Braves warm-up jacket. "You can't say one day, well, I think Toronto is great, but I'm for the Braves." The Bush campaign train will stop in nine towns as it travels 436 miles through Georgia, South, and North Carolina over the next 2 days. I'm Elizabeth Arnold reporting.
The State Department sought today to rebut Ross Perot's charges that the Bush administration led Iraq to believe that the United States would not respond if Iraq took over oil fields in the northern part of Kuwait. Perot made those charges during last night's presidential debate, saying that papers documenting the allegations had been withheld from Congress. He said that then U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, was instructed to tell Saddam Hussein that, in effect, he could take the northern part of Kuwait. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said today that no such instructions were given to Glaspie and that all the relevant documents had been provided to Congress. The Pentagon is releasing no new details on the latest evidence collected in Vietnam on American prisoners of war or missing in action. A spokesman said today President Bush will be briefed on Thursday and that the public can expect more information then. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Since last week, there have been reports that U.S. investigators in Vietnam have uncovered a cache of photographs of dead American soldiers. According to the Washington Post, there are more than 4,000 pictures taken by the Vietnamese of Americans who died during combat or in captivity. The Vietnamese government reportedly had the photographs, but until last week refused to acknowledge that they existed. It is possible that the new evidence will resolve some cases of soldiers who are now listed as missing in action. Retired Army General John Vesey, the special U.S. emissary for POW-MIA affairs, returned from Vietnam tonight. The Pentagon would not confirm that Vesey has brought back any of the photographs. A spokesman would say only that the results of his mission will be discussed Thursday. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 2 points to close at 3,186. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. The German Central Bank gave indications today that it may lower interest rates by the end of the year. The indication was no more than an announcement that the Bundesbank is returning to its old system of controlling interest rates, but that was enough to cause a surge in European stock prices. A new report by the human rights group Amnesty International accuses governments around the world of targeting children for human rights abuses. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Amnesty says that children all over the world are being killed, tortured, or imprisoned, often by the government of the countries involved. The report says that some of the children are perceived as a threat, while others are detained or tortured to get at their parents, and many simply have the misfortune of living in the midst of armed conflict. In Turkey, Amnesty says, Kurdish children have been killed by both government forces and Kurdish guerrilla groups, while in Peru, children have been killed by security forces and Shining Path guerrillas. In Brazil and Guatemala, the report continues, thousands of street children have been deliberately targeted by death squads. Amnesty also criticizes several governments, including the United States, for executing prisoners for crimes committed while they were minors. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
Forensics experts have begun to exhume skeletons from the ruins of a Salvadoran church where human rights workers claimed government soldiers carried out a massacre. The Reuters news agency said that 22 skulls and skeletons have been uncovered so far at a place where U.S.-trained Salvadoran soldiers are alleged to have killed more than 800 people in December of 1981. A member of the Argentine forensic team said that all the skeletons exhumed so far were children, including several babies, and that at least one skull shows bullet holes. Until the excavation began last Friday, human rights groups have based their allegations on the testimony of a woman who claimed to be the only survivor. The Salvadoran army has denied that any massacre ever took place. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night at the presidential debate, Gene Gibbons asked a question about a subject the candidates had not been addressing, the banking crisis. Gibbons pointed out there was little or no mention of the savings and loan crisis in the 1988 presidential campaign, and that crisis ended up costing us billions. He asked the candidates if there's now a commercial bank crisis on the horizon. Here's part of Ross Perot's answer.
Now, if you believe the Washington Post and you believe this extensive study that's been done, and I'm reading it, right after Election Day this year, they're going to hit us with 100 banks. It'll be a $100 billion problem. Now, if that's true, just tell me now.
Well, the Washington Post story that Mr. Perot referred to was co-written by my guest Jerry Knight with Susan Schmidt. Jerry Knight has been following the banking crisis for the Washington Post. This latest article predicts that the next president will find himself knee-deep in the S&L mess and facing another potential financial crisis, this time with the commercial banks. So, Jerry Knight, how did it feel to have your article brought up during the debate?
Well, it's good to see that the political candidates are finally recognizing this issue. 4 years ago, we went through an entire campaign with the savings and loan industry burning up, literally, falling apart before our eyes, and no one said a word about it. And finally now, 2 weeks before the election, someone has dared to suggest that the banks are in trouble. It's good to see that it's actually being attacked after all these years and months and weeks of neglect.
Well, your article discusses a commercial banking crisis in the works when a new regulation goes into effect December 19th, a regulation that will probably close a lot of banks. What is this new regulation?
It basically tightens the government's control over failing banks. In the old days, we waited for a bank to run out of money, to go broke, before we shut it down. Now the government has decided to step in a little before it reaches the brink. The idea is to minimize the cost to the taxpayers of cleaning up failed banks. That new regulation goes into effect in December, and as of right now, there are about 100 banks and S&Ls that don't meet the standards that they'll need to meet to stay open after that date.
Does this sound like a good regulation to you?
Oh, sure, it's a great idea. One of the mistakes in the past was waiting too long to close banks. So the Congress 2 years ago decided on a strategy called early intervention. The idea is to try to minimize the disruption to the borrowers and the savers when a bank fails. And that's a lot easier if you can step in before it's totally dead and bankrupt.
So how many banks are expected to close, and how many states do you think will be affected?
The current list is there are, as of the 1st of July, 86 banks that don't meet the new standard. There are also about 20 S&Ls that don't meet it. Most of those banks happen to be concentrated in a few states, Texas, Massachusetts, California, and Missouri. Some people are suspicious that those are also states with a lot of electoral votes, but I think the banking industry explanation is that those are states where there are banking problems that just haven't been recognized and dealt with.
Are these big banks, small banks?
By and large, they're not big banks. There's really only one big bank on the list. It's in Texas. It's failed once. It's called First City of Houston, and it's been on everybody's problem bank list for about the last 3 or 4 years, and that's not a surprise. Most of the other banks are smaller banks, and I mean in the 100 to 500 million in deposits range.
So is this going to be as bad as the S&L crisis?
No, as both of President Bush and Governor Clinton said last night, this is not in the same scale so far as the S&L crisis. We had about 1,000 S&L failures over the last 4 years, and the bank failure rate will not be nearly that great.
Is it coincidence that the date this regulation goes into effect is after the election?
Well, you have trouble convincing people that it's a coincidence because of the politics involved. But I really think it is. The date, the effective date was chosen at the time the law was passed. Congress said the law goes into effect 2 years after it's signed. The legislation really got stalled in Congress for about 6 months. I think it was originally envisioned that the signing date would have been sometime in the summertime. As it happens, it comes right after the election. And given the way politicians have buried the SNL issue, I think it's reasonable for voters to ask questions about whether they're trying to bury the bank issue. And the political questions are certainly understandable.
Let's look at some of the comments the presidential candidates made last night in reference to the question that was put to them about the banking crisis. Both Clinton and Bush said that they thought the banking system was basically sound. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's sound because we have very low interest rates right now. If interest rates were up 4 or 5 points, the banks would be in big, big trouble. As long as rates stay down, the banks can make a lot of money. They do that simply by not lowering the rates they charge on loans as much as they've lowered the rates they charge on deposits, so that, in essence, the banks are able to make money off their loans and cover up some of their previous mistakes.
Is that one of the reasons why the interest rates are so low now, to help the banks?
Most people believe that one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve has pushed down interest rates is to help the banks. The idea of lower interest rates is to stimulate economic activity, and certainly one of the direct beneficiaries is the banks. But consumers pay for that.
How do we pay for that?
Well, we think, most of us have mortgages, and we think of ourselves as big borrowers, but in fact, American families save a lot more than they borrow. And so we're saving on the one side. We're paying lower interest rates on our mortgages and our car loans and to a small extent on our credit cards. But we're earning much less money on our savings accounts. And this is particularly a problem for the elderly. The elderly are really paying a very large cost of rebuilding the health of the banking system.
Because they live on their savings,
and
their savings
aren't
generating much interest.
And the savings that were getting them 8% a few years ago are getting them 3 or 4 or 5.
Yet President Bush last night said that the elderly were really helped by low interest rates because they're not facing inflation anymore.
It's true that the lack of inflation helps consumers, but often the trade-off of interest rates and inflation benefits us. There were years during the 70s in which inflation was pretty high, but rates were pretty low, and you were better off borrowing money. Right now, that's not the case.
Now, last night, President Bush said that we need to pass financial reform legislation that modernizes the banking system, doesn't put a lot of inhibitions on it, and protects the depositors through keeping the FDIC sound. What reform is he referring to?
Well, the Bush administration 4 years ago announced a very broad plan to modernize the banking industry. They would permit pretty much unlimited interstate banking, so banks could go anywhere. They would permit banks to broaden their services they offer to consumers so that instead of giving you just a savings account and a checking account, they might sell you securities or mutual funds or help you invest in, do more retirement planning. That idea got nowhere in Congress. The small banks are adamantly opposed to interstate banking, and the securities industry and the insurance industry are opposed to letting banks get into their businesses. So the politics, the reality of the politics in Washington is that comprehensive bank reform isn't going anywhere, hasn't been going anywhere for the last 4 or 5 years.
Would the kind of reform that Bush is proposing be helpful to consumers?
It would help some consumers. It would help some banks. But there are many people who believe that comprehensive bank reform isn't going to solve all the industry's problems. Little banks don't benefit much from this, and of the 12,000 banks in this country, 10,000 are small banks, and they have no interest in branching into other states or selling insurance or becoming stockbrokers. It would help the big banks. Now, the advantage of this is it's the big banks that, by and large, are in most of the serious trouble.
Governor Clinton said he thinks the banking industry itself should pay for the cost of any bank failures. The taxpayers shouldn't pay. He said, that will be my policy. Exactly what would be his policy, do you know?
Well, that's exactly the policy of the Bush administration and the policy that Congress has adopted so far. The idea is that the Treasury Department is going to lend the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation enough money to handle the expected bank failures in the next few years. And the plan is that that loan will be repaid by the banks, that they will pay higher insurance premiums to the FDIC to make up for the losses. The question everyone has is whether the banks can do that, whether the banks will make enough money and will be healthy enough to repay the loan. There's considerable debate in Congress about that. There are many Democrats, including Henry Gonzalez, the chairman of the House Banking Committee, who thinks the banks simply won't be able to pay the loan and the taxpayers are going to get stuck with the tab, just as they've been stuck with paying for the S&L bailout.
Now, Perot said the whole problem came up in 1984 when the president was told the bailout would cost $20 billion. Perot said, I believe the vice president, Bush at the time, was in charge of deregulation. What was Bush's role during the Reagan administration in deregulating the banks or in decisions that led to the savings and loan crisis?
Bush chaired something called the Deregulation Task Force during the time he was vice president, and that task force promoted relaxing government regulations on a broad variety of industries. Banking was one of them. So the president has some, President Bush has some responsibility. In retrospect, though, no one has ever been able to say that President Bush pushed a particular program in bank deregulation. He generally advocated deregulation in sort of a broad sense. Now, Perot is also correct in saying that the problem could have been solved in 1984. Both Democrats and Republicans wanted to do that, but the idea just couldn't get through Congress. Congress rejected spending that kind of money because they were unwilling to get involved in the problem, and they didn't believe it was that serious.
Now, Perot also said, tell me what I owe now. Don't bury this till after the election. What do you think the reasons are that each party has decided not to bring this up during the elections?
This, I think, is a no-win issue for any politician. The taxpayers are unhappy about the S&L bailout. It's costing them about $300 billion. Congress hates the idea of spending that money, but they have no choice. And they don't want to talk about it. Bush doesn't want to talk about it because his son Neil was the director of a failed savings and loans that's going to cost the taxpayers about $1 billion. Governor Clinton has seen a number of S&Ls in Arkansas fail. He got a small loan from one of them. And more importantly, the Democrats are afraid of the issue because it was the Democrats in Congress who could have done something about this during the 80s and didn't want to touch it because some of their old party leaders were involved in the issue. Jim Wright, the former Speaker of the House, was up to his eyeballs. And we have the Keating Five, in which five senators, four of them Democrats, helped out one of the most notorious people in the savings and loan industry. And Democrats are just scared to death of this issue, too.
The Resolution Trust Corporation is managing the savings and loan bailout. Now, I believe the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation, ran out of money last April. How did it run out of money?
Well, they simply spent it. Congress has been doling out the money to pay off depositors in failed S&Ls very slowly and very reluctantly. Last spring, the FDIC got to the bottom of the barrel. They came back to Congress and said, hey, we've got a lot of S&Ls out here that are failing. We've promised to protect their depositors. We need a few more billion dollars. And Congress, in an extraordinary act, said no. A group primarily of conservative Republicans led by Newt Gingrich said, we're not going to vote this money. And it was the Republicans who blocked the administration's efforts to get this dough back. Now, the Democrats had their share of this. The Democrats simply said, we're not going to step up to the plate and provide this money if the Republicans won't do it.
Why not?
They don't want to take the blame. Nobody wants to vote for this. The politicians don't see providing money for the RTC as protecting the depositors in failed institutions. They see it as paying for the S&L bailout. And so they avoid dealing with it at all costs. They know that eventually the government is going to have to do this. But in an election year, no one wanted to say, well, I voted to spend $30 billion on those S&L crooks. No one wanted to be blamed for that, so they simply didn't vote the money. The result of that is that right now, the S&L bailout's pretty much on hold. Occasionally, the government will take over a struggling institution, but instead of shutting it down and paying off the depositors, they have to keep running it because they don't have the money to pay off the depositors.
So what does it mean, that we're going to owe more money in the long run?
Oh, sure. The official calculation now is that the cost of the S&L bailout goes up by $2 or $3 million every day just because of the delays. RTC has needed money since last spring, so we've probably wasted $500 million just waiting for this thing to be dealt with.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Knight, and he's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jerry Knight, who's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post, and it was one of his articles that Ross Perot referred to last night when he was responding to the question about the banking crisis. What do you think the relevance of this banking crisis issue should be for American voters?
Well, we should be concerned about it because the weak condition of the bank is holding back economic growth. Banks can barely afford to make loans. They've lost so much money on bad real estate and other unwise investments that they can't really give the kind of loans to small businesses that are needed to get the economy growing again. And a weak banking system will hurt our whole economy for a long time to come.
What about the amount of money that American taxpayers are paying? How much are we footing the bill for the banking crisis?
Well, so far, we're not paying directly in taxes, but we're paying it in subtle ways. The premiums that banks pay for FDIC insurance on their deposits really get passed on to consumers. That premium has gone from a couple of cents for every $100 of deposits to 28 cents for every $100 of deposits. And the banks recover that by paying you a little less interest on your checking or your savings account or charging you a little more interest on your loans. So that directly goes on to consumers. And the weak condition of the banks encourages them to try to rebuild their profits by charging higher rates. And we see that. Look at credit card rates. They've come down a couple of points at the most at a time when other interest rates are way, way down. So consumers are certainly footing a lot of the bill.
So we're paying for it with a little less interest in our savings account, and we're also paying for it in higher interest with our credit cards.
And even consumer loans, car loans, mortgages, the rates on all those loans are a little bit bigger because of the trouble the banks are in.
So with a commercial banking crisis a possibility now, how much money does the FDIC have to bail out banks that might close?
Well, the FDIC is essentially broke. It has about $6 or $7 billion in the bank, but that money is committed for banks they know are going to fail. The Congress has given the FDIC the right to borrow from the Treasury Department up to $30 billion. And once this next round of bank failures is over, they'll start borrowing from the Treasury. And that's our money.
When you say the money in the Treasury is our money, what does that mean?
Well, when the FDIC runs out of money, they'll start borrowing from the U.S. Treasury. And the taxpayers have put that money in, so the taxpayers will be at risk if the banks can't repay that loan.
Now, we're not going to get a bill in the mail that says bank crisis.
No, it's going to be just like the SNL crisis. You're never really going to know what hit you, but it'll be in your taxes. We're all going to be paying higher taxes for the next 20 years to pay for the SNL bailout. We gave the SNL industry about $300 billion to cover the losses of depositors' money caused by bad decisions by SNL executives. And that money goes into our tax bill. It makes the federal deficit bigger, and it forces the government to charge us more in taxes.
Does this mean that the middle class is going to be taxed one way or another, no matter what the candidates claim?
We're paying for this no matter what the candidates claim.
The immediate issue for all of us, I think, is if there is a commercial banking crisis, will my bank be one of the banks that fails? How can we make the right prediction on that and know what to do with our money?
It is tough. Every time we write a story about the condition of the banking industry, we get phone calls from concerned citizens who want to know what to do about their money. And my advice to them is remember that there is supposed to be a $100,000 limit on federal deposit insurance. And if you have money in a bank, be sure you don't have more than $100,000 in one account, and you'll be protected. The system for handling bank failures is amazingly efficient. I happen to have money in a credit union that failed. I didn't know it until 2 weeks after the fact. Often what happens when a bank fails is that the government will step in on Friday afternoon. They'll close down the ATM machines for the weekend. They'll reopen the bank on Monday morning, and that's it. If you wrote a check over the weekend, it went through. If you had money in the bank on Friday, it's there probably in a new bank on Monday. And the dislocation is very minimal. Usually it's just the lack of the cash machines being closed down for the weekend. In that system, depositors don't have an awful lot to worry about.
So you think that as long as you have less than $100,000 in your account and as long as you're at a bank that's FDIC insured, you'll be okay?
Exactly right. There are very, very few uninsured banks left in the country. Essentially, we have mandatory deposit insurance for just about everybody, and it's one of the great social programs in this country that works. It goes back to the Depression. If we hadn't had deposit insurance over the last 10 years, all these bank and S&L failures would have destroyed our economy.
I guess that's what separates the crises that we're in now from the Depression.
It is, exactly right. Deposit insurance works. Now, many people believe deposit insurance is part of the blame because it's put a lot of money into weak institutions. But the reality for most consumers is that deposit insurance lets you sleep at night. You know your money is going to be safe, and it minimizes this enormous disaster, and is really one of the reasons why it's not a political issue.
Some people say that the FDIC, in its own way, helped create the savings and loan crisis. Because savings and loans knew that they were insured, they could play fast and loose with depositors' money, and they lost immense amounts of money in making the wrong gambles.
That's certainly true, but it's also true that without federal deposit insurance, the savings and loan failures and the bank failures over the last 4 or 5 years would have been an economic disaster for this country. It would have been as bad as the Great Depression. We've had almost 2,000 financial institutions fail in the last 5 years. If you can imagine what would have happened if all those millions and millions of depositors had lost money, and think of what kind of shape the economy would be in, it would be quite different than it is now. This is a disaster in the sense that it's going to toss the taxpayers a lot of money, but 2,000 unmitigated bank failures would have brought our economy into a terrible depression.
Are there lessons that we should have learned from the savings and loan crisis that we can start applying to the smaller financial crisis on the horizon in commercial banks?
Well, one of the lessons certainly was to be very cautious about deregulating financial institutions and letting them get into new lines of business. We told the S&Ls in the early 80s that they could get into the commercial real estate business, and it was a total disaster. They lost billions of dollars because they didn't know that business very well. And many people are reluctant to go along with President Bush's idea of letting banks get into securities and insurance because they fear they'll be inexperienced in the business and will lose a lot of money. The other lesson we should learn is that when problems like this in an industry crop up, the government needs to move very quickly. I think that lesson has been learned, and that's why you're going to see this big batch of bank failures right after the first of the year.
What's the next step for you in covering this? What are you looking at for your next big story?
Well, we're waiting to see what's going to happen in December when this new law goes into effect. The betting is that Uncle Sam will not be Uncle Scrooge and will not start closing any banks down the week before Christmas. But probably right after the 1st of January, you'll see a very large number of bank failures. My estimate is that there will be 100 bank failures during the first 100 days of the new administration. The question then is whether that revitalizes Congress and gets them thinking about what to do about this problem.
Jerry Knight is a reporter for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the success stories, stupid moves, and lessons of a major network executive. We talk with the former head of NBC Entertainment, Brandon Tartikoff. He pulled NBC out of the ratings basement with such hits as Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, and Cheers. Now he's chairman of Paramount Pictures. Tartikoff has a new memoir about his years at NBC. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews The Choice 92, a new frontline documentary about the presidential campaign. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The next round of Middle Eastern peace talks involving Israel and its Arab neighbors gets underway tomorrow in Washington, with more than the usual uncertainty. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Negotiators return to the table aware that George Bush, who launched the peace process, may soon be out of power. Adding to anxieties is a resurgence of the Palestinian uprising in the occupied territories. Analysts expect little progress in the peace process before the U.S. elections, but afterwards there could be movement. If the president's reelected, he'll be eager to nudge the talks along. If he loses, his former Secretary of State, James Baker, freed of campaign responsibilities, may re-engage in the peace process for two more months. Martin Indyk of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy says the talks may break down if there's no breakthrough soon. Palestinian spokesperson Hanan Ashrawi told Reuters, people are getting more skeptical. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin told the French newspaper Le Monde the Israeli-Syrian talks seem more promising than the Israeli-Palestinian talks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Bush is now on a campaign train trip in the South, and he told supporters in Georgia today that the presidential race, in his words, ain't over. On a two-day trip through Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, Mr. Bush will be pushing for votes in a region that in recent elections has supported Republican candidates, but this year is leaning toward the Clinton-Gore ticket. The president has been defending his administration's policy toward Iraq after Ross Perot charged last night in Michigan that the U.S. was prepared to let Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein take over an oil-rich area of northern Kuwait. The Bush administration is unhappy with the terms of an agreement recently worked out by the U.N., to deliver humanitarian aid to Iraq. Officials say this agreement gives Iraq too much control over relief workers in the country. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The agreement would allow the UN to station 300 guards in Iraq, most of them in the Kurdish areas of the north. They would be assigned to protect aid workers participating in a six-month, $200 million relief operation. But the State Department today said that the agreement may be inadequate in some respects. One official noted that the agreement would allow Baghdad to control the travels of aid workers in the north, a region seen until now as largely autonomous. U.S. officials say that if Iraq won't renegotiate the agreement, the UN can bypass the government and bring relief supplies over the Turkish border. But U.S. officials acknowledge this raises safety concerns. They say Kurdish groups have been launching terrorist attacks on supply trucks entering Iraq from Turkey. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 2 points. This is NPR News. Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton, campaigning in the Midwest today, called on his supporters to stay the course for two more weeks until Election Day. As he campaigned in Michigan, Illinois, and Wisconsin, Clinton vowed to keep fighting and argued that he had the best economic plan for the nation. A Clinton campaign spokesman said there is still a lot of work to do and nothing is being taken for granted. And he said the Democratic ticket will be crossing the country in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. A surprising study in tomorrow's Journal of the American Medical Association finds that men who lose weight may increase their risk of dying from heart disease. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Researchers at Harvard University sent a series of questionnaires over a decade and a half to almost 12,000 healthy middle-aged men. As expected, those who gained substantial weight increased their risk of dying from heart disease. But to the scientists' surprise, so did the men who lost weight. Dr. Aimin Lee conducted the study.
Individuals who lost more than 11 pounds were at 75% increased risk of dying from heart disease when compared with those who maintained stable weight.
Lee suspects the men in her study may have been harmed not by weight loss, but by weight cycling, repeatedly shedding and gaining pounds. She says people who are obese should slim down and then be sure to maintain their lower weight. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
In Egypt, officials in Cairo say that there will be no building permits allowed for 1 year. Last week, a strong earthquake destroyed or damaged hundreds of buildings in the Egyptian capital. More than 500 people were killed and thousands were injured in the quake that measured 5.9 on the Richter scale. Poor construction was blamed for damage to many of the buildings in Cairo. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Brandon Tartikoff spent 12 years heading NBC's entertainment division before leaving last year to become the head of Paramount Pictures. Tartikoff was the first network programming head who actually grew up watching TV. He got the job in 1980 at the age of 31. In his years at NBC, he moved the network out of last place into first. How he did it is the subject of his new memoir, The Last Great Ride. He's perhaps proudest of his Thursday night schedule when it included Cosby, Cheers, and Hill Street Blues. For his very first primetime season, he premiered such new hit shows as Cheers, Family Ties, St. Elsewhere, and The A-Team. But the following year, all his new shows were flops, 9 new flops, including Bay City Blues, Buffalo Bill, Manimal, Jennifer Slept Here, Yellow Rose, and Mr. Smith. Who can explain it?
I need a second to just get over the migraine you just gave me.
I think Manimal probably really.
Yeah, but you have to remember that the first season, the one with Cheers, et al., all the way through St. Elsewhere and the A-Team and everything, all of those programs, with the exception of the A-Team, were under a 20 share of audience, back when under a 20 share of an audience was about 5 or 6 share points below what was the, you know, the acceptable range of what a show should get to be renewed.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really know what we had in the beginning with the shows we put on in 1982, yet we were feeling kind of giddy that the shows were at least getting well-received in the papers by the television critics. And we tried to top ourselves, and we were sort of like gamblers in Las Vegas. We had gotten a hot hand, and we were getting a little reckless at the table. So we succeeded with a program like Knight Rider about a guy with a talking car. So it wasn't that big of a stretch for us to go right from that to a show like Manimal, where you had a guy who, upon command, could change himself into any number of different animal forms. I mean, one sounds just as ridiculous as the other. And so Manimal crashes and burns, and Knight Rider goes on for 5 years. It's hard to predict these things at the time you're doing them, even through the end of the run of NBC, just because you had all these experiences and all these successes, it still didn't necessarily make your batting average any higher going in when you were involved with a new program.
One of the shows that you put on the air was The A-Team, which was very successful commercially, but you said it never did well in syndication and that action shows don't do well in syndication. That surprised me.
Actually, The A-Team of its type did okay in syndication. It went for a record amount of money, over $1 million an episode at the time. And I think one of the problems the A-Team had in syndication is that in syndication, for a show to work, there has to be sort of a favorite show syndrome. In other words, when you see Lucy in syndication, even though you've seen the episodes many, many times, you say, oh, that's where Lucy stomps around with the grapes in the vat, or, oh, this is where, you know, it's the episode with Lucy and the chocolates, or the various different favorite episodes of Lucy keep it an evergreen in television syndication. With the A-Team, after about 2 or 3 seasons, a lot of the hijinks and a lot of the plot lines began to blur. And I think in syndication, you're there on a Tuesday, you watch it, there's no compulsion on your part to watch it on the Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. That Thursday night schedule that was so successful. What was the logic behind the time spots for each of the shows there?
Well, Thursday night, like a lot of great nights of programming, is not a night that sort of just springs full-born all at once. You know, they're all members of the same class, you know, the entering class of 1984 or something like that. Family ties had been nurtured on Wednesday night for a couple of years. Cheers had been struggling for a couple of seasons on Thursday night, and Hill Street had been the lone show that had been successful as a fixture on Thursday night at 10. What happened was that with the with the power of the Cosby Show, we put it on Thursday night at 8 because Magnum PI, which was a top 10 show at the time we placed Cosby there, was starting to lose some steam. Its ratings were down from the previous season, and it's a dramatic show, and usually the way to bring down a program that has been a powerhouse and has been successful is to do what we would say is cross the forms. If you're against the drama, go with a comedy. If you're going up against a comedy, go with a drama. And Cosby was placed there to really try to get the full value for Family Ties and Cheers, and Night Court was also a transplant from Wednesday night from the season before. So what Cosby was, it was sort of like the breath of fresh air that went into the balloon and blew up the whole night to maximum kind of ratings.
I like Thursday nights a lot. I'm not talking about the TV schedule, just Thursday night in general, because it's the last working night.
Right.
The next day is Friday, and you've got the weekend. Does that influence what you put on a Thursday night?
It certainly, after we had the success on Thursday night, it certainly made us think that way, and I think others have discovered the value of having premium advertising on that night. It's the last night that retailers across the country, the people who depend on store traffic Monday through Friday, would love to get their messages across. It certainly taught me a lot about what not to put on Friday and Saturday night, which is shows that I think draw people back into the reality of their normal week, and as well as shows that require audiences to spend a lot of time thinking about whatever it is you're asking them to watch. Fridays and Saturdays tend to be escape night for the audience to get away from their reality, and consequently, the programming forms that have succeeded on Friday and Saturday night are generally more frivolous and have less substance than the kind of programs that, say, were on Thursday night or on Wednesday and Tuesday night on the other networks.
Brandon Tartikoff is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Brandon Tartikoff is my guest, the former head of NBC Entertainment, now the chair of Paramount Pictures, and author of the new book, The Last Great Ride. One of the programs that you put on the air was Highway to Heaven. Michael Landon had already been under contract to NBC. He pitched you the idea, and you decided to go for it. I found that story really amusing, because here's these kind of like two Jewish guys, you and Michael Landon,
right,
coming up with this show about angels coming down to earth. It's just not a very Jewish concept.
Well, when Michael pitched me the show, I said to him, now let me get this straight. You're going to play an angel of God each and every week. You're going to be the instrument of God, and you're going to help people with their lives, and you're going to write this, you're going to direct it, and you're going to star in it. I said, the critics are going to crucify you. I mean, you're going to be known as Jesus of Malibu. And he said, I'm Jewish, Brandon, so make it Moses of Malibu. And it's the kind of program where, you know, like the great shows, the most successful shows are great from the start. In the case of Highway to Heaven, it was like here was this sort of very, you know, egotistical kind of idea on the part of Landon to be all these things. But he had a great belief in his talents to move an audience. He wrote the pilot script in under 2 weeks. He shot it in time for pilot season. And when we originally screened the pilot episode, there were many members in the NBC programming department that didn't even want to play it the week when we all gathered to screen the pilots to decide the schedule, because they felt that, in the words of one executive, the only thing that was wrong with it was that it wasn't in black and white. That's how old-fashioned it was. We did send it down to testing. We did send it out to be researched and played for some sample audiences in five different cities. And it came back with the highest scores of any dramatic pilot in NBC history. And because we owed Michael a 13-week series commitment, we just sort of slapped it on to, again, an impossible time period, Wednesday at 8, where Fall Guy was killing us in the ratings. And it from the day it landed on the schedule, it won its time period.
You know what interests me? I can't, with all due respect to the late Michael Landon, I can't imagine you really enjoying a series like Highway to Heaven. So what was it like for you to sign a series knowing that you probably wouldn't like it yourself?
Well, Terry, you know, when you're the head of programming, you're not just putting on a 22-hour primetime schedule of what you would watch, because, you know, everybody has their own particulars in terms of education, background, interests, and everything else. And there were many programs, not just Highway to Heaven, that in a million years I wouldn't be canceling dinner appointments because I would want to be by my set when that particular show came on the air. That's not to say that you couldn't work on the shows. It's not to say that as sort of an impartial programmer, you couldn't be helpful in the show's story developments as well as its promotion and scheduling. But I don't want to give the misimpression that programmers only put on the shows that they like. First of all, I don't like a whole lot, so we probably would have been dark for about three nights out of the seven.
In your book, you write about how in 1982 you had a relapse of Hodgkin's disease, which you had first had I think it was 1975. And, you know, you talk about how when you have cancer, you really realize what matters in your life, what your priorities are. Now, 1982 was a really big year for you at the network. It was the year... It was a year when you had some important successes, and I think when the network ratings really started to turn around. And I guess I wonder what it was like to be at this kind of, you know, live or die stage of cancer, because you were pretty hard hit, and you were going through very kind of severe treatments of chemotherapy. So what it was like to be at this live or die stage with the cancer and going to work every day as you were. And part of what you had to worry about was ratings, you know, and whether shows you didn't like necessarily were going to succeed or not.
There tends to be a sort of life and death mentality that programmers or network executives approach their work with. I guess to sort of get them through the tough hours that the work demands, to sort of say, well, if this show doesn't work on Tuesday night, then the whole night is over, it's dead, and I'm going to lose my job, and after I lose my job, I'm going to be changing area codes, and I'm going to be, you know, without work, and all of those kinds of profound thinking that they sometimes bring to the job. When you're going through, a horrific experience like having a recurrence of lymphatic cancer, which is what Hodgkin's disease is, and you're actually being treated in a life and death manner for the disease, you tend to relegate your work to maybe what its real, you know, proper perspective is, which is it's a job, it's a better job than, you know, selling ties at the May Company. It's a job, and you're lucky to have it, and you're lucky to get to do it for as long as you get to do it, and you should be grateful for that, and I think you should be respectful of the audience and, you know, and patient with the audience, that if you're putting something good on, that eventually they'll find it.
Who at the network in 1982 knew you had cancer?
At the network? From my lips, Grant Tinker knew, who was my boss, the chairman of NBC at the time. I think others suspected it because when you're going through chemotherapy, you lose your hair. So I had one of those 100% undetectable hair pieces that... you see on late night television with the Hair Club for Men, and
yeah.
You know, I'm not just a member. I mean, I'm not just the owner, I'm also a member, yeah. That kind of stuff. So I had that, and my face was a little bloated from some of the cortisone-based chemicals that were coursing through my veins at the time. So I think people would recognize that I was going through something, and I might not have known exactly what I'd gone through. But since I had had cancer once, and because people, I think, in general, have a lot of mysterious notions as to what cancer patients go through and how curable are you. And getting back to the book for a second, one of the reasons I chose to share all this and to write this is the fact that, you know, I'm a very strong proponent that there needs to be more education on the part of the general public as to just the capability and the viability of someone with cancer still continuing to be not only functional in their jobs, but to excel at their jobs, because I rarely missed a day of work during the entire year that I went through, you know, the chemotherapy for the disease.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks.
Brendan Tartikoff is the chair of Paramount Pictures and the former head of NBC's entertainment division. His new memoir is called The Last Great Ride. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the presidential campaign one day after the final debate?
Hi, Terry. Elizabeth Arnold is following President Bush's campaign day, and Mara Liasson is with Governor Clinton as they get set for the last 2 weeks of the presidential campaign. Linda Wertheimer goes after the true facts about Arkansas, checking into claims made last night in the debate by President Bush. Also, Eric Weiner looks into James Baker's record as Secretary of the Treasury. Clyde Edgerton discusses his book about North Carolina, a fictional account of goings-on in the town of Summerlin, confusion about graves and tombstones. We also get to hear some great grandma stories.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The presidential debates are over, but the campaign continues, and so do documentaries about the candidates. Tomorrow night, PBS offers a special 2-hour Frontline program called The Choice 92. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
If I've learned anything in a lifetime in politics and government, it is the truth of the famous phrase, history is biography. That decisions are made by people, and they make them based on what they know of the world and how they understand it. And this is true of everyone, including presidents. So you must know us.
George Bush said that while running for the presidency the first time, but it's just as true today. And that remark by Bush is the way Frontline opens The Choice 92, which looks at the political and personal lives of George Bush and Bill Clinton. Now, right away, there's an obvious question. Where's Ross Perot? Frontline explains his absence in a prologue to the show. Basically, Perot was part of the original outline for The Choice 92, but when Perot stopped running, producer Tom Lennon and company stopped working on his segment. When Perot came back in, it was too late to do the kind of in-depth research Frontline had done for Bush and Clinton. Frontline offered to interview Perot and air the interview right after The Choice documentary, but Perot declined, so that explains what's not in The Choice 92. What is in it? Basically, 2 hours of images, interviews, and observations. All of them chosen to shed light, rather than heat, on two of the men running for president this year. 4 years ago, another Frontline producer, Sherry Jones, presented a documentary called The Choice, which looked at Bush and Michael Dukakis. This sequel lives up to the high standards of that original and benefits from the input and narration of author Richard Ben Kramer, who detailed the 1988 race in his book What It Takes. What makes The Choice 92 so unusual is that it reaches back so far and comes up with so much. You might expect the producers on this show to dig up old campaign ads showing Bush in action, but this documentary gives you a different Bush than expected, and I mean that literally.
Hello, everybody. I'm Prescott Bush, Republican candidate for the United States Senate. Some of our friends and television audience have asked if we have any pictures of the family. So here are a few shots that were taken last summer.
Clinton's parents, too, figure prominently in the first part of this show. We've all seen the picture of Bill Clinton shaking hands with then-President John F. Kennedy. But in The Choice 92, we get to hear Clinton's mother, Virginia Kelly, revealing what that picture actually meant to her son.
I just wish everybody could have seen the expression on his face when he handed that picture to me that he had taken with Jack Kennedy. I just wish everybody could have seen his expression when he came back from Washington. I knew it was politics for him. I knew it was.
Kurt Vonnegut once said that all of a sudden you wake up and realize the world is being ruled by people you went to high school with. This Frontline special takes that scary but true thought seriously and figures that going back to high school and even beyond is one way to learn a lot about a person's character. That word, character, has come to mean something almost sinister in this campaign. But when it's approached objectively, as in The Choice 92, an analysis of character really is illuminating. And that makes this Frontline special almost invaluable. No matter how much you've read, heard, or seen about George Bush and Bill Clinton, The Choice 92 will teach you something new. And that's a campaign year promise.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
With clients like Klaus von Bülow, Mike Tyson, Leona Helmsley, and Jim Baker, he's become one of America's most controversial lawyers. He's also one of the most outspoken when it comes to civil liberties. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alan Dershowitz. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.